Signed words to Ministry Queensland. It's now Friday evening, the 25th of March 1988, and we're at the Kelvin Grove High School Assembly Hall for a special lecture, with guest speaker being Mr. Lindsay Williams. His subject is the Plot to Control Australia. This is cassette number one of the evening.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Lindsay Williams from USA.
Glad you're here tonight. This is a wonderful audience. I was back in the back beside the book table a moment ago. A gentleman walked in and said that he had driven a few hundred miles to be here this evening. You know, I'm loving these Australian audiences. It wouldn't take much for me to fall in love with your countryside. We started out in one of your other cities and covered four different cities between then and now, have traveled quite a few hundred miles, and the hospitality of the people, the kindness that we found in your country, I'm just falling in love with it. And I want to thank you for being here this evening. Now, be assured, I'm glad I'm here. I can honestly say that. I came one halfway around the world to talk with you this evening. So I think I can honestly say I'm glad I'm here. I think tonight I must feel about like the little boy that his mother sent him down to the grocery store to get a box of these disposable diapers. The little boy went down to the grocery store and walked up and down the aisles and found a box of disposable diapers and walked back up to the checkout stand and put them down on the counter. The lady at the stand looked down at the little boy and said, "Son, that'll be $1.03 tax." The little boy looked up at the lady and said, "No, ma'am. My ma don't use tax. She used safety pins." Now, you've been sitting here, a wonderful audience, for the past 45 minutes and have hardly even moved. Your response has been good, but just before I speak, you need to stretch. Would you do something for me? Would everyone here stand, shake hands with two people, tell them you're glad they're here, and sit right back down again? Now, that made you feel better, didn't it? At the close of the session this evening, we will have an open forum whereby anyone in the audience can ask any question they wish. Please hold your questions until after I finish speaking, and then we'll give an opportunity for you to ask any question you wish. After the meeting tonight, in the rear of the auditorium, you will find our latest two books, Where's the Food? And Syndrome of Control, and if you wish to get those after the meeting, you can. Now, this evening, I've come here to try to deal with two words, to the best that I can, to explain it to you as I know it, as I've lived it, the story that has been a part of my life for the past 15 years of what's happening in the power elite structure of the world. And tonight, I'd like to deal with two words, freedom, slavery. We have two choices. We can make up our mind which we want. We will be one of the other, either free people or slaves. And in order to describe this subject, I'd like to start where it began with me. It was 1974. They built a huge pipeline in the United States of America for the carrying of crude oil. At that time, I was a missionary in the state of Alaska, and I heard that pipeliners were very likely people in need of spiritual guidance. So I went to the oil companies and I said, "Don't you need a chaplain on the pipeline?" Well, after I arrived on the pipeline, I found out what I had heard about pipeliners was the understatement of the year. Well, about 6 months later, the oil companies, who were paying us nothing, our religious denominations were supporting us there, the oil companies said, "You chaplains are saving us thousands of dollars of counseling fees. We've decided that we're going to give you executive status and make your life up here a little easier." At the time, I had not the slightest idea what that meant, but I soon found out it meant that I could go any place I wanted to on the pipeline, could sit in on board meetings with the oil company officials, and for 3 years' time, I was given executive status in an advisory capacity with the 9 major oil companies of America, and saw the building of the largest diameter pipe that's ever been constructed on the face of the earth for carrying crude oil. You'll remember that back in those days, there was a gasoline shortage. Well, at least that's what they told us. Well, after sitting in the meetings with the oil company officials, I found out there was no gasoline shortage. There was no energy crisis of any kind. It had all been intentionally created in advance. It was done for the purpose of manipulating the industrialized nations of the world. And to my utter dismay, I found out that the energy crisis was not created by the United States of America. Neither was it created by the Arabs, nor by your country, if you happen to have a shortage here. But rather, the energy crisis was created by a group of international financiers for the purpose of testing the industrialized nations of the world to find out what would happen. It wasn't unusual back in those days for me to have breakfast with the international secretary treasurer of Exxon. After all, when a person came to the pipeline and wanted to be shown around, it was my job as chaplain to host them. It was just part of my job. It was nothing unusual. I was just expected to do it. And then later on during the day to maybe be with some congressman who was visiting the pipeline, and possibly even that afternoon help host an Arab sheikh to look around the north slope of Alaska. This was just part of my job. And in rubbing shoulders with these people for 3 years, I found out something. They don't think like you and I think. These power elite of the world think in terms of power, control, manipulation, gain, greed. That's all they think about. They don't think in terms of love and Christianity and decency and honesty. Now, it's difficult sometimes for people to realize that there is a conspiracy. And I chose not to use the word conspiracy in my first 3 books because it's such a loaded word. Instead, I chose to use the word plot. It helps people to understand somewhat better, and possibly it doesn't startle them quite as much. But I'm here to declare to you tonight and attempt to prove to you that there is a plot, a conspiracy for the control of humanity, nations, both the United States and your own country of Australia. And at the invitation of Ian Murphy, who is the head of the Aussie Freedom Movement in your country, I traveled, and my wife traveled, halfway around the world to try to lecture in 20 cities to show you what I have learned over the past 15 years about the fact that unless we do something soon, we will be slaves in our own land. We have a choice. We can either be slaves or we can be free. The choice is ours, but we don't have long to make the choice. These people are on the midnight hour. They are soon ready to pull the strings. October the 19th in America, the stock market crashed. It was not by chance. They have some very definite things in the wind. And in order to prove this to you, exactly as I learned it by rubbing shoulders with these power elite for 3 years and then studying them for many years in order to write the 4 books that I have, I would like to begin this evening with a number of illustrations. After I have finished the illustrations, I will get into facts, cold, hard facts. Those of you who are on the front row are going to be glad you're there. If any of you in the back would like to move up closer, please feel free to do so right now, because I have some documentation here in my hand that those on the front rows are going to be glad you're sitting there, because you'll be able to see it as it is and can verify the fact that I'm taking it from where I say I take it from. So the other night I suggested this, and a number of people did move out of the back to the front rows. One man came up to Eon after the meeting, and he said, "You know, I sure am glad I took Mr. Williams at his word and moved up to the front row. I saw some rather startling things." So any of those in the back that would like to sit on the front, if you'd like to move up here, there are still some seats, please feel free to do so. And I'll guarantee you, before the meeting is over, you'll be glad you came here to actually see as closely as possible the documentation of what I'm going to give this evening. You know, this is what I love about Australian audiences. You're so impromptu, and this is the thing I'm enjoying about your country down under. I'm going to begin in my attempt to prove the theory this evening. Yes, there's some seats there, some here in the center. Thank you so much. I'm going to begin by coming right down home where you and I are. I'm going to start with a house mortgage in order to prove to you that there is a plot, there is a conspiracy for the control of every area of our lives. The first illustration I'll use is, let's say, for instance, that you bought a house on a 30-year mortgage at 15% interest. Now, I'm sure if you happen to have done that, you realize that over a 30-year period, you will pay for that house 3.5 times its original value. That means if you buy a $100,000 house on a 30-year mortgage with a 15% interest, you will pay $350,000 total, including interest and principal, on that house over a 30-year mortgage. Now, let's say that 20 years has gone by, and you've made your payments every month. All of a sudden, there's a financial collapse. The stock market, the bottom falls out. Currency devalues, as is done in many countries, and you can't make your payments for 6 months. The lending institution knocks on your door one day and says, "We're going to repossess if you can't make your payments." And believe me, they will. When they repossess that house, even though you've already paid for it for 20 years, and have already paid over $200,000 in principal and interest to that lending institution, yet they'll repossess that house. When they do they give you anything back? No, nothing. They merely repossess it because the fine print said you had to pay every month, and you were 6 months behind on your payment, so they repossessed. Then they turned around and sold that house again on another 30-year mortgage at another 15% interest. Got it paid for 3.5 more times. That means that the house was actually paid for 5.5 times its original value. Question. After 20 years, when they collapsed the economy and you lost your house, was it to their advantage to collapse the economy? Sure. They got your house back without paying anything for it, and you'd already paid for it twice. Well, let's go to another illustration. You'll find this in these two books. It's the Arab world. Now, let me go back a ways in order to explain how they conned the Arabs into what they did. Oftentimes, we are prone to criticize the Arab world and to say they're the richest people in the world, and they have stolen from everybody through the price of energy and oil. And when I got to Australia and saw the price of a gallon of gasoline, honest to goodness, if the Arabs had anything to do with it, they're robbing you but good. I thought we had high gasoline prices in America until I got here and found out what yours were. I would hate to have to drive around this country very long. Your prices are 2.5 times what we are paying for a gallon of gasoline in the United States of America. Well, let's look at this whole scenario as to why this happened. About 40 years ago, the international financiers, and notice where it started now, it did not start with the Arabs. About 40 years ago, the international financiers in New York found out that there was oil in Arab soil. So they went to the Arab world and they said, "We would like to build some oil fields for you. We'll produce that oil and we'll loan you the money to do it, and then we'll make you rich." Well, now, if you were a nomad roaming the desert riding a camel, you'd fall for that, wouldn't you? And the international financiers, whom the Arabs didn't know a thing about how cunning they were, they said, "If you will take the money that you make out of this oil and put it into our banks in 30-year time deposits, and we will pay you interest on that money, and then you can upgrade and improve your country and your people." So in every Arab world, they chose a few sheikhs and sheikhs. For instance, In the little country of Dubai, an Arab country, there are 300 sheikhs and sheikhs and 4 million people. Those 4 million people are given by those sheikhs and sheikhs everything. They're given housing. They're given school. They're given hospitalization. They're given everything that they want. It's a socialistic sort of a government. They're given everything. And as long as those 300 sheikhs and sheikhs give those 4 million people everything they want, all is rosy, is it not? So the international financiers made them rich. They were living in ivory palaces with gold-lined swimming pools. And finally, the price of oil went through the roof all the way to $32 a barrel. The Arabs became the richest people in the world overnight. And those men who had been nothing but nomads, roaming the deserts, riding camels a few years ago, now their children were out on the desert in their stretched Mercedes-Benz playing chicken. And they were flying their 747 privately owned airplanes around the world. And everybody said, the Arabs have arrived. Well, back in those days when the Arabs were raking money in like you wouldn't believe, the international financiers said, okay, boys, invest. Even that interest you're getting back, you can't spend it all. There's so much of it. Invest it. Well, they said invest it in treasury bills in the United States. Invest it in gold and silver. And by the way, what did the price of gold go to back in those days when the Arabs were getting $32 a barrel for their oil? Gold went all the way to $800, $900 an ounce. And the Arabs bought it by the train car load. Then all of a sudden, something happened. That $32 a barrel oil, the bottom dropped out. They were getting $9 a barrel and $10 and $12 a barrel. And something started happening to the Arab economy. Saudi Arabia fired their oil minister. They said he can't even keep prices up anymore. You see, the thing that the Arabs didn't realize was they never had anything to do with the price of oil in the first place. Who controls the price of a barrel of oil? The Arabs? OPEC? No. They don't have a thing to do with it. The men who sit at the computers in New York and purchase the tankers of oil every day, those men tell the Arabs what they are going to be paid for a barrel of oil every day. The Arabs have nothing to do with it. So after Saudi Arabia fired its oil minister, prices still stayed down. Well, at that point, the Arabs had to do something. After all, these 300 sheikhs and sheikhs in Dubai, those 4 million people, did you ever try to take a sugar stick away from a child? I mean, it just doesn't work, does it? So the big boys said, all right, guys, you're going to have to cash in. Well, what did they cash in? Treasury bills? No, can't cash those in. America's broke. $12 trillion national debt we have. We couldn't give them back their money on our treasury bills if we had to. But what else did they buy? They bought gold and silver. But wait a minute. What did they buy that gold for when oil was $32 a barrel? They bought it for $800, $900 an ounce. Then they collapsed the price of gold along with the price of oil. And the Arabs had to sell their gold back to the same people they bought it from. But what are they selling it back to them for? What was the price of gold today? What did it close at? About $440 an ounce. So the Arabs now having to sell their gold back by the carload because the international financiers collapsed the price of oil and they need money. So they're selling it back to the same people that they bought it from. They bought it for $900 an ounce. They're selling it back for $440 an ounce. I'd say it's a pretty good con game, wouldn't you? Well, look what Saudi Arabia did. Here it is. Out of the most reputable newspaper in the United States, the Wall Street Journal. I just took this out on December the 31st, 1987, and the article says, Saudi Arabia plans to borrow as much as $8 billion this year from the World Bank in order to finance its budget. Saudi Arabia never in its history has ever borrowed a dime from anyone before. For the first time this year, they are in debt to the international financiers. Mark my words, in less than 5 years' time, Saudi Arabia's oil fields will be again in hock to the financiers. They will keep the price of oil down right where it is today. They will break Saudi Arabia. They will refinance Saudi Arabia. They will put them in the same debt that they have put Australia in and the United States of America in. And eventually, they will re-own the very oil fields of the men that they made great at one time. And they did it all by a design plan. They knew 40 years ago what they were going to do. It did not happen by chance. It was all done by a diabolical plot on the part of the international financiers. How do I know? I sat in their board meetings for 3 years. I heard what they said. And after it was all over with, I dared to write a book entitled The Energy Non-Crisis, which told the entire story. After the manuscript was prepared, not a single publishing house in America would handle it. I sent the manuscript to every one of them. They all sent it back to me and said, "We can't handle it. You'll get sued. It's too hot of an issue." But within 2 years' time, it became a bestseller, even though it never went on a newsstand. Why? Word of mouth. All over the nation, people were hungry for the truth. They learned, and they took some action. And I dared to tell the story. And that's the very reason I'm here tonight. Because I'd like to explain that story to you exactly as I knew it, personally, and saw it firsthand. You do know, of course, what number one red square downtown Moscow, Russia is? Oh, yes. It's Chase Manhattan Bank. That's right. The same bank is downtown New York in the United States of America. Why is that bank in Soviet Russia, in Moscow, number one red square? Why is it there? No Russian is allowed to go into the bank and have a checking account or a savings account. They don't believe in free enterprise in Soviet Russia. Then why is the bank there? For one purpose and one purpose only. To finance Russia's war machine. To build their tanks. To loan them money to make their missiles work. The exact same bank is downtown New York and finances America's free enterprise that builds America's aircraft and tanks and guns. They love it. Whenever a president goes off to meet with Mr. Gorbachev and comes back and says, negotiations broke down. America's got to build more arms, and Russia builds more arms. Chase Manhattan Bank finances Soviet Russia's war machine. Chase Manhattan Bank finances America's war machine. They financed both sides of the First World War. They financed both sides of the Second World War. They financed both sides of the Vietnamese conflict and the Korean conflict. They love it whenever there's war. They make money off of both sides, and they don't care as long as they have the control. Are you beginning to get the picture? Well, Congressman George Hanson did. He was a congressman in the United States of America for 12 years. Very respected gentleman from the state of Idaho. Congressman Hanson finally resigned or left Congress. And one day he and I were on the platform together in a speaking engagement. And he said to me, "Lindsay, there were some stories that I wanted to tell when I was in Congress, but I couldn't. If you'll print them, I'll tell them. And you'll find it right here. It's one of the most startling exposés that you'll ever read. And the one that I'd like to relate to you this evening that will show the wickedness and the control factor of the international financiers were the Iranian hostages. Do you remember when they were held for 440 days? The Shah had been deposed. The Khomeini had come back from France to Iran and took over. 440 days, American hostages were held. Congressman Hanson wasn't satisfied that he was getting the truth in the Congress of the United States of America. And he asked if he could go to Iran and investigate. The Congress of the United States of America, even though he was a congressman at the time, the Congress said, "No, we'll give you no authorization to go to Iran." Fortunately, Congressman Hanson doesn't stop that easily. He reached in his back pocket, paid his own airline ticket, went to Iran, and when he got there, to his utter dismay, Khomeini gave him an audience. The first thing that Khomeini said to him was, "Congressman Hanson, we don't want these hostages any more than you want us to have them." Oh, you weren't told that by the media in Australia, were you? Neither were we told that by the media in America. The next thing that Khomeini said to him was, "Congressman Hanson, I'll give you one half of those hostages to take home with you tomorrow morning if you will call back to Washington, D.C., and get the Congress of the United States of America to promise to start an investigation into the relationship between the Shah of Iran, Chase Manhattan Bank, Henry Kissinger, and President Carter. Now, you'll find the story minute by minute, hour by hour, exactly as Congressman Hansen lived it in this book. He also placed it in the congressional record in Washington, D.C., in our government's records before he ever left Congress. Yet the nation was never told the true story. So Congressman Hansen called back to Washington, and he said, I can bring home half of the hostages with me tomorrow. He lists the name of the individual, by the way, in this book that he talked to in Congress. And he said, what do you say? The individual in Congress said, I'll call you back tomorrow. America held hostage, the whole world in a crisis, and I'll call you back tomorrow and tell you whether to bring home half the hostages or not? Well, the following day, the individual did call back, and his reply was, Congressman Hansen, you have no authorization to negotiate on the part of the Congress of the United States of America. Get on the next airplane. Come home immediately. Do not bring any hostages with you. When Congressman Hansen returned back to America, he continued his investigation, and here's what he found out. He found out that President Carter knew in advance that the hostages were going to be taken. He found out that he knew almost to the day how long the hostages were going to be kept. He also found out that the release of the hostages was not negotiated by the government of the United States of America, but rather the release of the hostages in Iran was negotiated by negotiators from Chase Manhattan Bank in New York City. It was not a crisis between America and Iran. It was a banker's crisis. Chase Manhattan Bank was on the endangered list by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in America. They had to have the Shah's money into their bank. They arranged things so that the Khomeini got back into the country. The Shah was deposed. The hostages were taken. They embarrassed Iran. Iran couldn't turn loose of the hostages until the money was put in Chase Manhattan Bank. And only when the Shah's money was delivered to Chase Manhattan Bank were the hostages released by order of negotiators from Chase Manhattan Bank itself. And you'll find it right here in copyrighted form, exactly as Congressman Hansen lived it. Do you really think they cared anything about America or the world or the crisis? No. They cared about only one thing, that they had what they needed in their pockets and that they became wealthy no matter what might happen to the world. There is a plot for the destruction of your freedom and of mine. Well, the latest crisis in America is this one. My wife and I decided we had to tell the story. I understand that you're having a similar crisis right here in Australia. I took this out of your own newspaper. It came from the Weekend Australian, and it's dated in 1988. And it says, the death of the family farm. It goes on to say, Australia will lose one farmer every 2.5 hours for the next 25 years. We'll end up with a few wealthy landlords like the Philippines. This came right out of your own newspaper. Well, if you think the farmers in your part of the world are having trouble, the American farmers, the farms, are going into bankruptcy on the average of every 3 minutes a family farm declares bankruptcy. What was 5 years ago, thousands and thousands and thousands of acres across America being tended, today that land is being laid idle. Who's confiscating the property? The bankers. Who's buying up the little banks? And I'll show you before the evening is over tonight that we're having massive bank failures in America today. I doubt that you're hearing the story down here. I'll show you the newspapers right from the United States of America to prove what I'm saying. And that's the reason I said you'd be glad that you were sitting in the front rows tonight. Massive bank failures across our country. And the banks, the little banks that are failing in the farm communities, are being bought up by the big banks in New York who seem to have an unending supply of finances to buy anything they want. And I'll get around to Australia in a few moments to show what they will be doing to you shortly. So as a result, the farmers are going under at the rate of one every 3 minutes. We calculate that within less than 2 years' time in the United States of America, there will be shortages on the grocery store shelves and hunger in our cities. I dared to tell the story in the first book printed to tell the plight of the family farmer. And this book there is also here for you tonight to see what's happening in the United States of America. Now I'd like to make the most critical statement I'll make the entire evening. It may take a moment or two for it to sink in as to just how critical this is. But here's the statement. A number of the leading money analysts of America have calculated that as of February the 1st, 1988, for the first time in modern history, as of February the 1st, there is officially now more debt in the world than there is the ability to repay. February the 1st was the date of the point of no return financially for the world. May I briefly explain? Take the debt of the world, that is the Americans' $12 trillion debt and the Australians' national debt and the third world's debt, and take the private debt and the credit card debt and the personal debt. Take all of the debt in the world that is owed to the international financiers in the form of interest and principal. Take all of that debt and add it together. Then take all of the currency in the world, all of the gold in the world, all of the land in the world, all of the collateral that you can possibly figure in the world, and as of February the 1st, there was officially more debt than there was the ability of all the collateral in the world to repay. It has all been created out of thin air by interest, by the international financiers who wished to put the world into a debt situation so that they could foreclose. And any time after February the 1st, they can officially foreclose on the world. There is more debt than there is the ability to repay. Watch out. You've heard of the aircraft that strikes out from its home base, going in one direction. There is a point at which that aircraft can no longer return back to home base because there's not enough fuel in its tanks to do it. As of February the 1st, the point of no return on the face of the earth, for the first time in your lifetime and mine, officially was designated. There is a plot for the control of Australia, America, and the world. Now, some people, I'm sure, I can tell by looking at the faces, I'm seeing some unusual expressions out there tonight. I'm sure some people must be saying, wait a minute, Mr. Williams, you are alluding to a conspiracy. Well, let me ask you a question then, if you have trouble with conspiracy. And here's my question. Show me any time down through history, anywhere you'd like to go, whether it be modern or ancient history. Show me any time where there has not been someone, some nation, or some group of people conspiring to control humanity. Whether it be the Caesars of Rome, whether it be the rulers of Babylon, whether it be modern-day Hitler's Germany. Why did Hitler go after the world? He had the whole nation bowing down at his knees, calling him a god. He had all the money a man could want. Why did he go after the world? One reason and one reason only. Power. Greed. He was mad for the control of humanity. And he went after the world. It caused a war such as this earth has never known before. What is there today? There's a group of approximately a dozen people today who are known as the internationalist, is the word that I chose to coin in my book, Syndrome of Control. I rubbed shoulders with a few of them when I was with the oil companies on the pipeline. I've talked to some of them. These people have one goal in mind. Remember, the name of the game is control. That's all they want. They want to control you and me. But I have a message for them. I have no intention in being their slave. Now that I have given you enough theory, and for lack of time, I will cease with any further theory. I noticed one lady looked at her watch. Am I doing all right? Yeah, thank you so much. Now I'd like to go into the proof. You know, I never worry about people when they look at their watch. It's when they take it and shake it like that and put it up their ear that it bothers me. I sometimes tell people that I speak by the calendar instead of the clock, but I promise tonight I'll stick with the clock. It'll be much easier. I'd like to go now into the proof of my theory. And I want to quote Mr. Ronald Reagan, President of the United States of America. I personally watched the TV when he made the following statement recently nationwide on a newscast. And here's what he said. Quote, "They tell me I'm the most powerful man in the world. I don't believe that. Over there in the White House someplace, there's a fellow that puts a piece of paper on my desk every day that tells me what I'm going to be doing every 15 minutes. He is the most powerful man in the world." I'd like to elaborate briefly on that. And a statement that may startle you, so that you'll understand where Australia can stand in relation to America if it ever comes to a crisis. The President of the United States of America is, for all practical purposes, under house arrest in the White House today. Startling? I'll explain. A friend of mine recently, who knew Mr. Reagan years ago personally when he was an actor in Hollywood, needed to get some information to him. You see, the State Department of the United States of America just completed giving away five islands off of the coast of Alaska to Soviet Russia. They are oil-rich islands, and it was never voted on by the Congress of the United States of America. It enraged some of us American citizens, and we tried to get some information to President Reagan to tell him what the State Department was doing. We couldn't get the information through to him. Mail it to Washington, staff never let him have it. There was never a reply, even though we tried many methods. Finally, this individual said, "I know I can get this information to Mr. Reagan. I knew him personally when he was a Hollywood actor. Whenever he's out in public somewhere, I'll walk up to him and maybe I can get him to greet me. And if he will, I'll hand him the portfolio of information." He did. He went where he knew Mr. Reagan was going to be. He was in the crowd of people. Mr. Reagan saw him, greeted him, shook hands with him. He talked with him for a moment or two. After he had talked with him for a moment or two, he reached in his pocket, pulled out the portfolio of material, and handed it to President Reagan and said, "President, you need to read this. It's vital to our security." One of the Secret Service agents standing beside President Reagan took the material out of his hand, looked it over briefly, looked back at President Reagan and said, "President, you don't want to read this." He took it in his hand and walked away. The President of the United States of America today knows only what they want him to know. Nothing gets through to him except what they want to get through to him. For all practical purposes, he is out of touch with what's happening in the nation except what they want him to know. Well, we're having some financial problems in America. You know, I can talk about my own nation. Some of the financial analysts of our country have written some reports recently. I'd like to read a few that will startle you. This one is written by Dr. Pierre Reinfret. He was the economic advisor to both President Kennedy, President Johnson, and President Nixon. He said, after the October the 19th stock market crash, he said, "In the near term, we're going into a recession, and I think it will be quite severe. We are in serious economic and political trouble and have absolutely brutal days ahead." One of the economic advisors to three of the presidents of the United States of America in the past. Again, James Davidson, who wrote the book that became famous in America entitled Blood in the Streets, he wrote recently and said, "This is the beginning of a major depression. Although he expects the stock market to bounce back up and down several times before the final crash." Donald McIlvaney, again, one of the most recognized money analysts in America. I talked with him on the telephone personally 2 days before I left America to come to Australia. He said, "A stampede of foreigners out of U.S. stock in the bond market is a growing possibility. A total U.S. and then worldwide financial collapse will follow." One of the leading money analyst of the country. Well, when I got to Australia, I found it in your own newspaper. We won't take it just from America. In fact, I clipped this one out of your Sydney Morning Herald on Sunday, March the 19th, 1988, just a few days ago. You know, whenever two companies decide they want to get business from each other, they get mad at each other. Sometimes they tell the truth, don't they? This one is good. In fact, the Bond Link Trust Company in Sydney, Australia, wanted to get some business from another trust company. So they took one half of a page in the Sydney newspaper, and they tell the truth about your savings in your bank accounts. You really think it's safe to put money into a savings account in Australia, in a bank, or any kind of an institution? Well, now, I'm not saying this is a foreigner. Your own newspaper says, I never thought I'd see this in print. This is the most fabulous thing I've seen in a long time. I'm going to take this back to America and show it to them. This is good. Here is what this Bond Link Trust Company says. It says, suppose you place money into a bank in a savings account at 12% per annum interest. And he said, they go on to say, that in Australia you have a 7% inflation rate. That means that 7% out of that 12% is immediately cut off or done away with or annulled by the inflation rate. Then he says, if you're in the 50% tax bracket, and I hope every one of you are, but let's say that you're in the 50% tax bracket, the taxes that you will pay on that money plus the inflation rate at the end of the year, you will have 0.5% less money than what you had when you put your money in the bank. You see, you can never win by either paying or getting interest. It doesn't work. It's a deadly game. Well, it's so deadly until this is what's happening in the United States of America. I was in Denver, Colorado on the day that this was the headlines on the newspaper. Denver, Colorado, one of our 50 states and a city in that state, it says, U.S. stings 156 Colorado banks. Did you know that in one of the states of the United States of America, on one Friday afternoon, that the government closed down 156 banks in one of our states? Did you know that? No, you didn't. And you never will. I'll tell you why. Because the rest of the United States of America didn't know it either. I was in four states adjacent to the state of Colorado in the next 3 weeks after this, lecturing, and nobody knew anything about this. There was a media blackout as off the state borders of Colorado, and the rest of the United States of America never knew this. Why? They didn't want the people to know it. It might have caused a run on the banks and some massive bank failures. Because, you see, even one of our leading economists in America and writers, Jack Anderson, he's probably the most recognized columnist in America today, he dared to print in one of our leading magazines the following. It says, is your bank account safe? I mean, this man is a liberal. He's not even a conservative. And he dares to say, your bank account's not even safe any longer. Well, my wife and I heard about this one and decided we would investigate. It's one of the atrocities of the money system. Anywhere you find it in the world, and it could happen right here in Australia, because Bedford, Iowa, little bitty town down in southwestern Iowa, farming town in America, and Bedford, Iowa, the newspaper says that one Thursday afternoon that the federal agents appeared on the doorstep of the bank, the only bank in this little farming community. There's the man's picture. And declared that the bank was broke. Well, the bank wasn't broke. The bank was solvent, doing great. But it says Army closes Bedford National Bank. The men were armed when they stood on the doorsteps of the bank. And you see, the farmers who had borrowed money from that bank, they failed to read the fine print. Oh, you do read the fine print every time you sign a note, do you not? At your bank? I mean, your banker explains all of that little fine print on the back of the note to you? Doesn't he? No, he doesn't. And you take the note home and read everything on it before you ever sign it, don't you? The fine print included? No, you don't. Well, neither did the farmers in Bedford, Iowa. And so when the bank was closed by the federal agency, in a few days' time, 150 farmers in Bedford, Iowa, received a message through the mail that they were being foreclosed on. And if they could not pay 100% of what they owed the bank within so many days, they were going to confiscate their property. Because, you see, in the fine print, when the farmer signed that note with the bank, it said that if the bank ever went broke, that the people who took the bank over could automatically demand payment, and if payment in full could not be made within so many days, that the farm would be repossessed. What does the newspaper go on to say? 150 of them lost their farms. Who got the land? The bankers. What did they do with it? Let it lay idle, like it is today, because they want a food crisis. After all, the ultimate control factor is the control of food. When a person's hungry, they'll do anything. You let your child start crying, and you'll sell the coat off your back to put some food in his mouth. They know it. And they know that if they get the farmer off the farm and bring about a food shortage in the world, in America, in Australia, wherever it may be, that it is the ultimate control factor of any people in any nation. Well, it happened in Willows, California. Same thing. My wife and I heard about it. We went to Willows, personally investigated, and they closed the bank there, confiscated some loans, just exactly like they did in other parts of America. How'd they do all this? Very simply. They did it with fractional reserve banking. Have you ever heard of it? Oh, it's practiced in Australia. Sure it is. Practiced in America too. Perfectly legal. Every lending institution in Australia uses it, as far as I know. And every lending institution in America also uses it. Now, in order to understand fractional reserve banking, I need to find someone here in the audience who looks like a banker. You see anybody around that looks like a banker? I'm looking for somebody with a nice coat on, his hair is combed, and yeah. Oh, you're pointing to this gentleman over here? All right, don't move. The gentleman's sitting right over here. Yeah, the fellow behind him is pointing to him. He must be your friend to be pointing to you like that. I see the gentleman. He has some salt and pepper gray hair, and his tie matches his coat. And I think I can look under the chair and see his shoes are polished. He looks like your friendly, smiling banker who would never do you wrong. You know those bankers? And I'm going to take this gentleman sitting right here on the front seat. Now, just stay right where you are. I'd like to use you an example. Say that you have $1,000 that you would like to deposit in your friendly, smiling banker's bank who would never do you wrong. Now, God forbid that you'd ever do it. I'm sure you have better sense. But just in case you wanted to deposit $1,000 in his bank in a savings account. So you deposit that $1,000 in the bank, and that bank in America, and I understand very similar in Australia, is required to keep 5% of your deposit in the bank. And they can loan out 95% of your money. So that means your $1,000 deposit is deposited in your friendly, smiling banker's bank who would never do you wrong. And that bank is required to keep $50 of your money on deposit. And you can loan out $950. And you loaned it out to this gentleman sitting right here on the front row who wants to build a room onto his house. So you take the money down to the building supply place, and the building supply place does business with Bank B across the town from Bank A. So the building supply house deposits that $950 into Bank B. Now, Bank B is required to keep 5% on deposit and can loan out $902.50. That money is loaned out to this gentleman sitting right here, who filters the money back into the economy through the hardware store and the grocery store into Bank C. That's on the other side of Bank A and Bank B. And Bank C is required to keep 5%, which is $45.13. And they can loan out $857.37 to this gentleman sitting way over here, who filters it back into the economy, into Bank D. Bank D is required to keep $42.87, which is 5%, and can loan out $814.50. Now, the other day, my faithful computer and I were traveling across America. We had about 3 hours on a jet, and I calculated this thing all the way down to zero, and here's what I found out. Sir, your $1,000 deposit in your friendly, smiling banker's bank who would never do you wrong. Those bankers, using fractional reserve banking, are allowed to loan out legally by your country and by America the following amount of money, $20,229.60. Oh, by the way, that's only the principal. That doesn't even include the 15% interest. What is the interest known as? The interest is better known as the national debt. Every day they turn the presses up faster and faster and faster and print more paper and put it into the economy in order to keep the fractional reserve banking from collapsing. As one banker said to me recently, fractional reserve banking is designed to collapse. And it will soon. Have you heard of, sir, we will take questions and answers at the close of the session tonight. And as long as I'm on the platform, if you will please hold your question to the end. And I promise you at the end of the session tonight that yours will be the first question that I'll call on. And there'll be a microphone where you can politely ask your question and I will gladly answer it after I finish speaking this evening, if you will, please. You have heard of privatization in Australia? Is it an issue down here right now? May I tell you why your government is pushing privatization? I doubt very seriously if you knew what the Congress of the United States of America did. On August the 13th, On August the 13th, 1987, the Congress of the United States of America passed a bill giving banks in the United States of America, those are the international financiers banks in New York, the World Bank, the right to own 100% of any and all foreign corporations. Prior to August the 13th, 1987, a corporation or a bank in the United States of America or the World Bank could only own 30% of any foreign corporation's stock and holdings. As of August the 13th, an American bank, the International Financiers Banks in New York, can own 100% of your airlines, your railroads, your bank, or any corporation in Australia. Isn't it quite interesting that about the same time that your government officials were pushing privatization, that the Congress of the United States of America passed that law? You know who will own your airlines? After all they do is just reach out into thin air and create money from computers. They don't have anything to back it. They don't have to have anything to bank it. It's known as the World Bank. It's known as the International Financiers. And who will buy your corporations? Oh, they won't buy them directly from Chase Manhattan or Chemical Bank or Morgan's Bank. Who will they buy them through? They'll buy them through some other company that they form, and through that company they'll make the money available, and they will buy your corporations. And whenever they complete it, the corporations that have been designed by privatization to be a savior to Australia will be owned by none other than those who have put America into its $12 trillion debt. The very people who put the third world countries into their indebtedness. They will own the corporations of Australia. 5 years from now, you'll look back and remember the statement that I made tonight. Why? They did it in Canada. Oh, they didn't tell you about that, did they? I was in Canada recently. I lectured at the University of Regina. After the meeting, in the open forum at the end, which I wish the gentleman had remained for, I would have been more than happy to have entertained his question. But when I was at the end of the session, a student at the University of Regina stood to his feet and said, "What do you think about the free trade agreement that's just been signed between the United States of America and Canada?" I said, "Sir, the free trade agreement, which will allow free trade back and forth across our borders and no taxation, just as it wishes, between any corporations," I said, "your free trade agreement is going to be the destruction of Canada." He said, "Why?" And I showed him the article out of the Wall Street Journal stating that on August of 1987, that now corporations and banks in America can buy 100% of foreign corporations. And I said, "They will own Canada. They will control you within less than 5 years' time." Well, what have they done to the America's currency? You know, I think if I talk about my own nation, then you can draw some conclusions as to what's happening in yours. I have in my hand a $1 bill from the United States of America. It's called a Federal Reserve note. First of all, we Americans have found out that it's not federal. It's owned by a privately owned corporation by the name of the Federal Reserve, which is not a corporation, is not an agency of the federal government. Secondly, there is no reserve. There's nothing on there to say that this is backed by anything. Used 2 years ago, said it was backed by gold or silver. Today, it's not backed by anything. Thirdly, it's not a note. That's right. Now, since I picked on my own currency, may I talk about your Australian currency for a moment? Would you allow me? I mean, I'm an American. I know I'm down here as a guest. But would you allow me to read two phrases on your Australian currency? I have a $2 Australian bill in my hand. And it says, Reserve Bank of Australia. Who owns the Reserve Bank of Australia? I don't know. I'm only asking the question. It might be wise to investigate. You see, we thought the Federal Reserve in America was owned by the Congress of the United States of America and its people. By close investigation by such men as Eustace Mullins, who are very brilliant people, went all the way to the National Archives and wrote some phenomenal books on the Federal Reserve, we found out that the Federal Reserve of the United States of America is owned by a group of international financiers, over half of them not even being citizens of the United States of America. That only came about when there was very careful investigation in the National Archives. Secondly, on your Australian money, it says, Australian note is legal tender. Will you please do me a favor when you go home tonight? Will you please look in your dictionary and find out what the meaning of the word note is? If you'll look in your dictionary, if it's the same as the American dictionary has in it, you'll find out that the meaning of the word note is that in order for something to be a legal note, it must have a promise to pay on it somewhere in some amount of something. Otherwise, it is not a legal note. Now, in America, there is no promise to pay in any amount of anything on our money. There was at one time. It promised to pay in gold and silver. In Australia, what backs your currency? Is there any promise to pay on this note anywhere in any amount of anything? Then in America, we call them green stamps. Because that's exactly what they're worth. The paper they're written on. And watch the American dollar and mark my words. In the very near future, you're going to see the American dollar plummet. If you think that your floating currency is in trouble now, wait till the American dollar, which denominates all oil sales, plummets to rock bottom, and we in America, who are on the inside of some of this, know what's happening, and we are expecting the American dollar most any time to make a definite plummet down, and when it does, watch out for the world currencies. May I explain to you briefly what they've done to us? I have this $1 bill in my hand, and in my other hand, I have an Australian 50-cent piece. I'm going to pretend that it's an American silver dollar. In the United States of America, 40 years ago, they minted silver dollars. It had 1 ounce of silver in it, and it was called a silver dollar. And 40 years ago, you could have gone into any bank in America, you could have taken one of these Federal Reserve green stamps, called a $1 bill, into the bank, and you could have bought one of these silver dollars with it. Today, 1988, you take one of these Federal Reserve notes, $1 bills, into any bank in America, and you can still buy a silver dollar. But you know how many of these you pay for it? 15 in order to get one of these. Now, what changed purchasing power? This or this? The silver dollar will still buy today exactly what it would buy 25 years ago. Will this? No. This will buy approximately 13 cents off what it would buy 25 years ago. Who did it? Well, let's go a little further in order to explain this. I'm going to pretend that this is a 1 ounce gold piece minted in the United States of America 50 years ago. And on that 1 ounce gold piece, it had printed on the front $20. Now, 50 years ago, you could have taken that 1 ounce gold piece into any tailor shop in America, could have laid that 1 ounce gold piece on the counter and said, I would like to buy the nicest three-piece tailor-made suit you have in the shop. And 50 years ago, they would have sold it to you for that 1 ounce gold piece with $20 stamped on the front. Today, 1988, take that exact same 1 ounce gold piece into the same tailor shop downtown New York, lay it on the counter and say, I'd like to buy the nicest three-piece tailor-made suit you have in the shop. And this morning, they would have still sold it to you for that 1 ounce of gold. Why? What did gold prices close at today? $440 an ounce. Now, on the front of that 1 ounce gold piece, do you remember what was printed on it? $20. And 50 years ago, you could have taken 20 of these and you could have bought that 1 ounce gold piece. So today, 1988, take 20, $1. Federal Reserve green stamps into the same tailor shop, downtown New York. Lay them on the counter and say, I would like to buy the nicest three-piece tailor-made suit you have in the shop, and what would they do? Probably sell you the tie to go with the suit, wouldn't they? Why? What changed purchasing power? The paper or the gold? The gold is still worth today exactly what it was worth then. The paper is worth 13 cents of what it was worth back then. Are you beginning to get the message? Yes, there is a plot for the control of America, Australia, and the world. The two words are freedom, slavery. We have a choice. The choice is yours and mine. You know why I came here tonight? One reason and one reason only. I was not paid one penny by anyone to come to Australia. I will be lecturing in your country for 5 weeks without 1 cent of remuneration from anyone of any kind, either in America or Australia. You know why I'm here tonight? For one reason and one reason only. I will not be a slave. Will you? Eon, would you come down here a moment? I'd like you to do something for me right now. Would you please put a big smile on your face? I know we've had some very unusual facts given this evening. A lot of theories that are very disturbing. Eon, come on up here. I want the folks to see you in a moment. I'd like to give you some cures. Now, the reason I ask you to put a big smile on your face is because I think it's time to turn this thing around. I believe we can see America turned around. I believe we do have time to see Australia turned around. And if it's going to be done, it's going to be done by men like this. He's the founder of Aussie Freedom. Australians United. Eon is they call you a grazer, is that it? He doesn't do the grazing. His cattle does. But they call him a grazer. And Eon has a lot of sheep and cattle. And he left all of that. He's out here now trying his best to tell Australia the truth. He formed an organization named Aussie Freedom. He's heading it up all himself, every bit of it, the whole thing. And I think as long as there are men like this around, that we have time to turn Australia around, don't you? Thank you, John. In our latest book, Where's the Food?, my wife and I decided that we would put some cures. In none of my other three books did I ever print any cures to the problem. But I'd like to give you some cures tonight whereby we can turn America and Australia around. Because, you see, the only way that I, as an American, am going to stay free is for Australia to stay free, too. If you become a slave, I become a slave. Because the same people that caused our national debt are bringing about your national debt, and they have a reason for what they're doing. Now, for the next moment or two, if you'll allow me, by the way, you're getting tired. Can I take another 5 minutes? I'd like to give you seven cures whereby I believe we can turn this thing around. And you'll find them printed beginning on page 214 in the book, Where's the Food? Number one, get out of debt. Debt is a vicious cycle. Debt will enslave you. The Bible says the borrower is servant to the lender. Indebtedness has enslaved your nation, and it will enslave an individual. Number two, beware of usury. Usury is like a wheel with no end. You get into it, you can't get out. I decided a few years ago that I would not allow the international financiers to use Lindsay Williams' money anymore. In fact, it was a little over 5 years ago now. I went down to my local bank and I closed out my checking account. Haven't had one for over 5 years. I'm not going to let them take my money and use it fractionally reserved, which is dishonest in anybody's moral book. And I said, not only that, but I'm not going to pay the interest anymore. It took me about 6 months to pay off all my loans. And then I closed out my savings account. I said, they're not going to use that for fractional reserve banking either, your friendly, smiling banker who would never do you wrong. And I closed it all out. You can't imagine how happy my wife and I are the 10th of every month. Number three, set some family priorities. Do you remember the day and time when mother could stay home? Families could be taken care of by father's salary. He made enough money to put clothes on the back and a roof over their head. Thank you. I like that. Go ahead, ladies. And he put an automobile in the yard and everything was fine. And then mother had to go off to the job. Who sent mother off to the job? Daddy didn't do it. Government did it. International financiers did it. They devalued your money. Don't blame your elected officials. Blame those who control your elected officials. They're the ones that sent mother off to the job. I think it's time to set some family priorities, don't you? Put mother back where she belongs. My wife says she don't want to be liberated. She likes to sleep in till 10 o'clock every now and then. Number four, get involved in government. Oh, I know you say, regardless of which administration we get in, we get the same decisions. That's all right. Get involved in government anyway. And once you get a good elected official in there, don't let them alone. President Reagan said to his son recently in Los Angeles, California, when he was at the Reagan Ranch. It was at Christmas time, and I met President Reagan's son when I was in Los Angeles, and he said that his father said the following to him two Christmases ago. Son, they won't let my friends get to me anymore. Will you please tell my friends that I still need them to keep trying to get information through to me? President Reagan's own words to his son. Once you get an elected official in there, you got to stay with them. Because the powers that be will not let you get the truth through to them if they can help it. Next, not only get involved in government, take responsibility for your health. You do know there's a health conspiracy, do you not? Yes, there is. Not only a spiritual one and a political one, but a health conspiracy. One illustration out of this book, a farmer in California that we interviewed. The farmer raised corn and hogs. Last year, American farmers got $1.40 a bushel for their corn, and it cost them $1.60 a bushel to raise it. So this farmer decided that he couldn't afford to sell his corn on the open market. So he decided that he'd do what Granddaddy used to do. and what his dad used to do. He would turn the hogs out into the cornfield, get them fat, then take them off to the market and slaughter them and at least make some money that year. So he did. He turned his hogs out into the cornfield. The hogs started getting sick. 60% of them died. He called in the vet and the county agent from the government. And he said, "Gentlemen, what's wrong? Why are my hogs dying?" The vet and the county agent laughed at him. He said, "Wait a minute. Don't laugh. This is serious business. I've just lost 60% of my hogs and my whole corn crop." The veterinarian looked at the farmer and said, "Sir, I'd like to ask you two questions. Number one, what kind of seed did you plant when you planted that corn?" He said, somebody already knows. They've already said the word over here. He said, "We planted hybrid seed." You know what hybrid seed are, do you not? Oh, they grow beautiful corn, monstrous ears, big, beautiful stalks. But after about a year or two, they won't even sprout anymore. Then the veterinarian said, "What kind of fertilizer did you use on your soil?" Oh, he said, "Chemical fertilizer." He said, "Sir, don't you know that you cannot use hybrid seed and chemical fertilizer, that the corn does not even have enough nutrient in it to feed a hog? You have to supplement them or they'll die. Now, if it's doing that to hogs, what will it do to humans?" I think it's time that we learn the issues about health and do something about it. Number six, stand up to your adversaries. If we don't stand for something, we'll fall for anything. And I think it's time to stand up and do something about it. Number seven and lastly, turn your life over to Him. Capital H-I-M. If America or Australia is to be turned around, the Lord's going to do it. I will believe that God has failed. Whenever I look out the front window of my house some morning, to the top rung of the fence, and find all the robin redbreast lined up waiting on welfare, until then, I will still believe that there's hope for turning America around and for turning Australia around. We can do it. We will do it. I refuse to be a slave. And I've traveled tonight one halfway around the world to tell you what I know as I've learned it from being there. There is a plot. There is a conspiracy. And they want you and me. But I have a message for them. They aren't going to succeed. Every human being is two parts. We are physical and we are spiritual. We must be free in both parts in order to be totally free human beings. The Bible says, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." A person can live in Australia and have your constitution, and under that constitution have physical freedom, but yet not know Jesus Christ as their Savior, and be a slave to sin, and be one half free. Be physically free, but spiritually a slave. But yet that same individual could live in Soviet socialistic Russia, under the tyranny and the dictatorship of that country, and could be physically a slave, yet have believed that Jesus Christ died on the cross and paid the price to forgive their sins and to make them a born-again believer and take them to heaven, and could be spiritually free, but be one-half free. I want to be both spiritually free through Jesus Christ and the precepts of the Bible, and physically free through the Constitution of the United States of America. Then and only then am I totally free. I said tonight that I'd come here to Australia because I will not be a slave. Would you say that with me? I will not be a slave. Once again, I will not be a slave. And I don't think you will. And I've seen a lot of expressions on your face tonight, and I'm sure you have some questions. And I promised a question and answer session. Can we take 10 minutes? Will you promise not to leave if we take 10 minutes of questions and answers? Okay? But you've been a marvelous audience. All right. You've been a great audience. You've been sitting here for over an hour while I've been talking. Yes, I'm going to take the latest question right here first. I love this. Here, she's got her hand trying to go up and her husband's pushing her hand up. Isn't that great? Now, just before we take some questions and answers, would you do this for me? If you'd like to ask a question, step up to the microphones. Would you please stand, stretch, and sit right back down? Now, if you leave, we won't have a question and answer session. Thank you so much, and you may be seated. That just relaxes us enough, and if you don't mind, I'm going to take my coat off. It's warm up here on this platform. All right, there's a microphone here. There's one here. If you have a question, please step up to them, and we will take them. Yes, right here. All right, you're going to have to quieten down a little bit. I guess the mic is not working, so I'll have to repeat the question. Could you say it as loudly as possible, and I'll try to repeat it.
Just to our Queensland people, that I, in the Fraser government, we formed the Australian Pensions Party, and we had the state executive here in our own state. And fortunately, we had our finance Secretary Eric Robinson, I think you would all know him, and he was here in Brisbane. And I said to him, to think of Australia, save it. We've had two world wars, we've had our children, and we're married, grandchildren, young people. And I also mentioned about the pensions and the unemployment, where, as far as I'm concerned, there was no need for it. So I said to Eric, will you please go back to Canberra and tell them to sit down and think of our people, our grandchildren, the ex-servicemen that fought for the war, and to create work for this nation. And I've been involved in politics off and on. And last year, I did a petition for Canberra, but getting back to Eric Robinson, I found out about 3 years ago that we did do some good. He went back to Mr. Fraser and Labor, and there was a meeting in the Senate, and the seed was planted, but unfortunately, it didn't get into the federal, into the House of Representatives. And I just want to see the Australian people to have the courage to stand up for their rights, voice your opinions, and I've also got a petition at home, but I haven't been well enough to get into it towards the end of last year and this year. But it is there. And I want that help. It was going to be nationwide, which is a lot of organisation. And that is on to change the Australian Constitution for the people and not for the government. Now, we can do it, the same as America. And thank God for America and England. And it is not too late.
There are people concerned about Australia. Let's give this lady a hand. Isn't that great? Thank you so much. All right. Question right here in the center. And please speak up if you can, because I haven't been here long enough to get you Australian brogue yet. I'm trying my best. But I may miss a word every now and then. So please speak up if you will. All right. assuming that the Australian government has the will to do so, what keeps them from telling the international financiers to go jump in the lake? I think that's the best that I remembered, exactly like he said it. They have the power to do that. I understand that your constitution gives you the right to do with your money as you wish to. You even have your own Australian bank whereby you can coin your own money if you wish. So it could happen if enough of them knew the issues and you people pushed it.
The Constitution doesn't allow us to do that now. That Constitution's been torn up.
Okay, well, I don't know that because I'm not an Australian. But I do know that the masses of the people, keep in mind one phrase, and I'll leave you with this, and then we'll go to another question because the lady has her hand up back here. Gentlemen, one phrase. Governments never act. They only react. Don't ever forget it. The only way your government's ever going to do anything is to react to your pushing them. They will never act on their own. And it's only when you people rise up and say, this is the way we want it, they'll do it. And listen, they have the power to do it. Yes, back here. Speak up good now, please. Okay, what would be my estimation of that action? I'll tell you what happened to me 2 days ago, right here in your own country. We've been collecting some $1 coins and some twos and fives, and we're getting, you know, a stack of them after books were being sold. So Leon said, shouldn't we get that into some larger bills so we don't have to carry around the little bitty bills? And we went into a bank in a certain town, and it was the largest bank in the town. And we said, we'd like to get some large bills. They said, we do not have one single $100 bill in the bank. And they said, furthermore, we can only give you a few $50 bills. Be very careful of banking. I don't know what the condition of banking is in Australia. And I would like to answer your question more after the meeting tonight. So if you'll come back to the table in the back, I'll be back there autographing books. And maybe I could help you personally in that way. Would anyone else here like to respond to this man's question? All right, there was another question down here. I think the gentleman. Yes.
I'd like to ask you, do you know anything about a connection which is said to exist between the international oil monopoly, the one-season hybrid seed syndrome? I believe there is a nexus, a financial and a physical tie-up between the two. Could you tell us anything about that?
All right. Just a minute. Don't leave the microphone yet because I'd like to clarify your question. You're asking about the connection between the oil monopoly and
the hybrid seed production idea.
Okay. The oil monopoly and the hybrid seed.
We know of a case in South Australia where a man had to tear up his crop because of it.
Yes. The connection between the oil monopoly and the hybrid seed and the fertilizer, which is inorganic fertilizer.
Yes,
we have a story in here of an American farmer who went to borrow money for the bank in the springtime to plant his crop. The bank said, we will only loan you money if you will use chemical fertilizer. Come to find out that the oil company was doing business with the bank and had told the bank that they would quit giving them their business if they did not require farmers to use chemical fertilizer. This farmer the year before had used organic fertilizer and had paid off the majority of his bank loans, and the bank wanted to keep him in debt, and so did the chemical fertilizer people.
Yeah. So I understand they control the seed business. I understand they control the seed, the one-season hybrid seed production, too.
Yeah, they may control some of the hybrid seed production. I do not know that for a fact, but they may very well. All right? Another question right down here, sir.
Runs from to America to hide or to escape, and yet run straight into the hands of the people who he supposedly knows about, and then ends up in jail, and is allowed to telephone the information that they're trying to keep secret out to you.
All right, the question is, how does a man such as Jonathan May, who many of you have seen the tape, the audio, the video that I gave on this man's expose to me, how could he run from Great Britain, wind up in America, go to jail, still be allowed to call from jail and give out this information? Jonathan May left Britain because his life had been threatened. He thought that there was freedom in America. Quote, when he got there, he found out the same people that control Britain control America. He made one mistake. He decided that he would do the same thing that the Federal Reserve System of America is doing, that is, issue paper without backing. That's all it took for the courts to put him in jail. One day, Jonathan May said to me, Lindsay, I'm afraid they're going to scramble my brains. They do have the ability to do that. He said, the next time I call you on the telephone, please have a tape recorder hooked up to the telephone, and as fast as I can, I want to give you some information because I'm afraid I will never come out of jail to be able to tell it. Now, in America, a prison inmate is allowed for so many minutes per day to call out to a local call, or if it's a long-distance call, it has to be collected. I'm sure that the call was recorded. I wouldn't doubt that at all. But he did get to the phone. There was no one else in line for the phone. He called me, and as quickly as he got on phone, he started giving out the information, which you heard his voice. All I know is he did it. Now, the part of the information that Jonathan May gave me that I could prove, I used. Now, I did not use everything Jonathan May told me. There's a lot of that tape that was cut out because I could not prove it. And I, as an author, will not use anything that I can't verify. We went to Arab sources, as you heard on the tape, my explanation of it. We went to Arab sources, verified certain parts of Jonathan May's information, and then that part of his information only did I use. I am not a part of his organization. I have no relationship to Jonathan May except that he told me that on the phone that day. What I could prove, I used. And as a result, it's been a real help in explaining to people what's happening in the world system. All right. Right back here, sir. All right, the gentleman is asking that possibly if people do not understand what it means to be born again, they might not understand what it means to have complete victory over this system and a knowledge of what the system is doing. And he's suggesting that I explain what it means to be born again. I'll be more than happy to do that. In fact, I do it in one entire chapter in my book, Where's the Food? My wife and I co-authored together. And in this book, you will find one full chapter explaining the plan of salvation. Any of those of you who cannot afford this book, I'll see to it you have a copy of that chapter. For those who can, you'll find it in detail. I ask you please to read it because it'll be the most important thing you ever read in any of my writings. All right? Over here, sir. Is there a heavy involvement of the Japanese in the World Banks? I wish I had time tonight to give you a lecture of about 30 minutes on what happened in Japan. Japan is in terrible trouble right now. I just received McIlvaney's newsletter just before I left America. I brought it with me, read it in the car the other day, and he gave the facts and figures and statistics on what's happening in Japan. After the last World War, the international financiers were the ones that financed Japan. They still hold all the purse strings of Japan, even though they're doing it under the auspices of the Japanese banks. And right now, they are in the process of deindustrializing Japan. It's going to be a horrendous thing that's going to happen because in Japan,
They don't have a system like we know in America or Australia. But a family in Japan depends on that a company that they work for from the time of the cradle to the grave. They give them everything. Housing. They see to it that they get vacations. That company is their life. And right now, they're closing up automobile plants in Japan. Japan is on the verge of some major problems financially, even though we thought they were doing great. Maybe I can get you some of these statistics. But it's startling what the international financiers are doing to Japan. Same thing they did to America years ago. So don't take too much stock in the fact that Japan's doing all right. In the next year or two, Japan will be in some real trouble. All right, take one more question. Yes, right back here, sir.